The chairman of Renault Nissan, Carlos Ghosn, has been arrested. Japanese media say he's being questioned over underreporting his salary. The auto giant's already moving to terminate his contract and that of another senior manager. It says it's discovered misconduct, including using company money for personal purposes.
A group of Asia-Pacific leaders failed to find consensus for the first time in their history on Sunday at a summit in Papua New Guinea, highlighting a divide between China and the United States. Instead of the usual joint communique, Papua New Guinea leader Peter O'Neill, the host, was left to give a rundown of how talks unraveled. When asked why the 21 members of APEC failed to agree, he said, "You know the two big giants in the room." APEC stands for Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, though as Reuters' John Mayer explains, cooperation is hard when your two big members are in a trade war.
Tensions boiled over in the Mexican border city of Tijuana on Sunday. Hundreds of protesters hitting the streets, demanding that the massive caravan of migrants from Central America leave their country. Some holding signs reading, "Say no to the invasion," and singing the Mexican national anthem. Demonstrators accused the migrants of causing chaos and breaking the law.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Tuesday. It's November the 20th, and it's 5:10 in the morning. Thank you for being here with us for another edition of The Opening Bell and another business day getting underway. That is, unless you're lucky enough to have the whole week off this week for Thanksgiving. A lot of people do. You can tell just by the commute in and out of work this week. But we're happy you're here if you're working, even if you're not, and listening to us this morning. We've put together a really good broadcast for you today. We'll have a conversation this morning about how the next big thing for transit, public transit, could be a sort of Uber for public transit. David Bragdon will be here. He's the executive director at transitcenter.org, a transit advocacy group, to tell us why that's a bad idea and why it might always be best to take the bus in our first segment this morning, the bus. And a little bit later in the program, Orrin Cass will be here. He's a senior fellow at Manhattan Institute for Policy Research and also the author of a new book called The Once and Future Worker, A Vision for the Renewal of Work in America. And we'll have a conversation with him about that coming up at about 5:40 this morning. But first, let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. The opening bell rings this morning after a down day on Wall Street kicked off a short trading week. The Dow Jones Industrials took a nosedive, losing nearly 400 points. Yesterday, shares of Apple were down about 4% as the company announced it's cutting production orders for new iPhones. Amazon shares were down about 5%. Facebook shares down nearly 6%. So a rough day for tech stocks on the market yesterday. This morning, as we look ahead to the opening bell, futures down on the Dow more than 0.5%, down 157 points. The NASDAQ is down more than 1%. NASDAQ futures off 77 points. And S&P futures are off more than 0.75 points. Again, heading to the opening bell at 8:30 Chicago time today. Markets in Europe and Asia are all lower. In Europe, nearly 1% in Germany, nearly 1% in France, more than 0.5% in London. And in Asia, markets also significantly lower this morning. The Nikkei is going to finish down about 1%, 238 points. The Hang Seng is going to finish down nearly 531 points, down 2%. The Shanghai down more than 2% as well. And oil is trading at $57.17 a barrel. General Motors is likely to lay off at least 3,000 salaried workers in North America after fewer of them took the automaker up on a buyout offer than hoped. GM has offered voluntary buyouts to about 18,000 people with the goal of at least 7,000 taking the early out by yesterday afternoon. Newspaper reports out of Detroit reports the job cuts could start in January. Buyouts were offered to employees with at least 12 years. With the automaker, recreational marijuana stores are opening in Massachusetts today. The state's Cannabis Control Commission announced last week it had authorized two stores to begin selling marijuana products. Massachusetts is the first state on the East Coast to legalize recreational weed. And a leader of a conservative campaign to unseat Prime Minister Theresa May has acknowledged that the rebels don't yet have the numbers for a leadership change. They are upset that May has, in their view, mishandled Brexit, the exit from the European Union. Well, let's begin this morning with a conversation about public transportation and the future of public transportation. The next big thing is called, in rideshare space, could be called Uber for public transit, where you call on your app for a bus that comes directly to your house. But a top transit advocate says we have been there and done that. David Bragdon is executive director of the transitcenter.org, a transit advocacy group, and he is with us this morning. David, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Good morning. Good to be here. Thanks.
We saw this piece recently about how the bus is still best when it comes to transit. I believe one of your colleagues is one of the authors of this article talking about all these different sorts of transportation methods these days, Uber, Lyft, scooters now, but how the bus is really still standing up to be the best of all of those. Talk to us a little bit about this and this idea that it still remains the best.
Sure. Well, when they're operated properly, that is, you know, with the right levels of frequency, with the right kind of bus stop environment, with the right type of schedules and connectivity, which is, you know, typically how buses are operated in Europe, they're you know, basic technology that really scales very well. It's a versatile type of vehicle that that can be used in, you know, in multiple parts of the city at relatively low capital costs. So most transit systems, including those in Europe or Asia, where they do also have extensive rail systems, the bus is still often the backbone of the system just because of that versatility and the ability to, you know, expand it pretty broadly across the city at lower capital costs. But it does have to be operated in the proper way in terms of reliability, meaning it has bus lanes, which has priority at signals, so that you get the speed and reliability and sort of the factors that the customer really wants.
And is that why we're seeing other modes come into play here? I know this article talks a lot about micro transit, but I mentioned Uber and Lyft and some of these other ride-sharing groups. Is that why that those seem to be coming into play now, is because the bus systems are not operated well in the United States?
Sure, most bus systems in the United States are really not operated at you know, optimally in terms of the frequency and the reliability. And the rise of app-enabled ride hailing is in part filling that gap. The economics of it, though, are still unclear in that venture capital is funding some of the app-enabled ride hailing companies. The drivers who are, you know, using their investing in automobiles to drive for the app-enabled ride-hailing companies, by most studies, are not making a very good wage at all. So the financial sustainability of those companies, as well as their inability to serve large numbers of people at scale just because of the space issue. I mean, if you're talking about the loop, you know, you can't get 400,000 people into the loop if each of them is in a car, whether somebody else is driving it or whether it's automated or driverless. It's just a matter of the space. If every passenger is in a 2-ton steel box, it just takes up too much space. Whereas the bus and transit really does work at scale, particularly in dense environments where you have large numbers of people that need to be moved.
What are then, I know your group is among those sort of out there in public talking about it. What is the conversation that's happening right now between organizations like yours and city transit agencies about improving bus systems so that it is not watered down even more?
Well, right now, in Chicago, for example, Active Transportation Alliance has been working really hard with the Chicago Department of Transportation and with the CTA. That's a great example of trying to create some priority for buses in terms of bus lanes and signal priority to expedite the large numbers of people that can be moved by bus. So I think Chicago is, and the outgoing mayor recently announced some commitment to improving buses and the street conditions for buses. And, you know, you're fortunate in Chicago, you have The mayoral basically, the mayor basically controls the CTA as well as the Chicago Department of Transportation, so he or she can really direct a concerted effort on the part of both those agencies to make things better for bus passengers, you know, who in Chicago, you know, numbers in the hundreds of thousands of people depend on the bus, and more could if they were more reliable and frequent.
And no, places like Seattle, there was recently, I guess, a voter referendum there where they voted to give funding, better funding to the bus service. And what happened there as a result of that?
Well, Seattle, they're very shrewd about the measures of success. And they basically said what we want to do is increase the number of people who are living in our city who are within walking distance of a transit service that comes every 12 minutes or more frequently than that. Doesn't matter if it's a rail line or it's a streetcar or it's a bus line or it's an electric bus, but we want people to have that access. And so that led them to invest at scale in the bus system because they could scale that up pretty quickly. And the result is that ridership is going up. Now, of course, they are building a rail system as well, and parts of that will open in the 2020s or even into the 2030s. But in the meantime, they're really expanding the frequency and reliability of the bus service and using all the different tools that they have. And that's a good example. Houston has also, in the last few years, totally revamped their bus network and recognize that where people live and work today is different than 30 or 40 years ago, and they needed to straighten out the routes and connect the places where people want to go. So there are a number of cities, and again, it's great that Mayor Emanuel and the CDOT and CTA are joining in with that trend. It's very encouraging to see that happening.
I mentioned earlier this notion of microtransit and that trend sort of developing out there. Tell our listeners what microtransit is and why it might not be such a good idea.
Well, it's all a matter of scale. You know, that a bus that's carrying, you know, that's carrying 40 or 60 people and, you know, going down, you know, you name it, Western or Ashland or you know, major arterials that's boarding 40, 50, 60 people per hour with one driver and one vehicle, that's a very efficient use of space, a very efficient use of labor, a very efficient use of the capital assets, very efficient use of the street space. Whereas if you have vehicles that are dashing around and trying to go from one person's door to another, but in the meantime, they're deviating to go to another person's door. They're basically just physically not able to board more than maybe five or six people in an hour, which is really not very efficient in terms of the labor cost or the street space. And it actually just doesn't add up physically. It sounds great on the surface when you say, oh, well, here's a vehicle that's going to come to your door and take you to where you want to go. Well, that sounds great till you think through the implications, because the implication is that it's also going to go to somebody else's door on the way, and then on the way from that person's door to where he or she wants to go, well, we're going to go out of your way to drop somebody else off. So, you know, it doesn't add up at scale in terms of the travel time or the efficiency of the asset.
And
there are certain conditions where it makes sense if you're talking between, you know, 1 and 5 in the morning or particular parts of the metropolitan region that are low density, where you want to have that type of service and it makes sense. But at an urban scale, around the clock, it really just doesn't add up.
Yeah, and it's something that we've tried before. I think it used to be called Dial-A-Ride, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, it's been called a number of things, dial-a-ride or demand-responsive. And again, it sounds great to the individual. It's just when you think through the physical implications of these things going to and fro, and, well, you know, well somebody wants to go from one part of the region to someplace else. I mean, it just sort of duplicates the auto-oriented system that we have right now in terms of traffic and congestion.
What a kind of technology as we move to the future. A lot of us love using technology. I think that's a part of the popularity of Uber and Lyft and some of these scooters. You can just dial up the thing on your app. How does that translate, though, into the conversation we're having about the old-fashioned bus? Is it going to be that we have the automated buses, robotic buses? How do we put transit, that kind of transit, into technology?
So, well, certainly automation is much, much, much easier if you're talking about a vehicle that's going along a fixed route and is doing the same thing every day and every hour, and you have a right-of-way that is really clearly, you know, mapped in technological terms, and you know, there are obviously fewer adaptive sorts of surprises in that type of context than trying to program a vehicle to go, you know, hither and yon all over the place under all kinds of conditions. So in terms of prospects for automation, certainly buses are, you know, are an easier technological challenge than automobiles. And that's, in terms of that technological leap of the operation. In the meantime, technology can really incrementally improve the old-fashioned bus in terms of, for one thing, providing better information to consumers in terms of real-time about where the bus actually is, when it's about to get, you know, when it's going to be here, in terms of being able to pay a fare by app and not having to deal with cash. And if there is still a driver, the driver not having to deal with people paying their fares or people lining up, they can get on at the back doors as well and be able to pay that way. So there are certainly a lot of technological things as well with terms of dispatching, in terms of keeping buses on schedule, you know, rather than somebody standing out on the street corner with a clipboard and a pencil kind of tracking where the buses are. You can do that remotely and really maintain the interval between buses much more reliably than currently is the case. Technology can also help to keep turn the signals green or keep them green for transit. So there's all kinds of things that technology can do to incrementally change the bus, just like, you know, moving from steam locomotives to diesel locomotives in the railroad industry, or moving from prop planes to jet planes in the aviation industry. It's, you know, it's an evolutionary step that makes an existing technology and its underlying strengths, and it just modernizes it and makes it better.
Yeah, and with an automated system, you get rid of the driver, which is a huge part of the cost of transit in the first place.
It is the major cost. It's also, you know, one of the, I mean, the workforce that deals with customers and is the face of transit, and is, you know, one of the, you know, the primary elements of safety, for example, is also, you know, a highly trained professional driver who is qualified to do that job. So yeah, labor is the big cost, but it's also an asset in the sense of dealing with customers and delivering a safe, reliable product.
If you had to bet, if you had a crystal ball, how would you predict transit is going to look in 5 to 10 years?
Well, I think that transit will concentrate what we think of today as conventional public transit, which is, you know, larger vehicles at scale. Will increasingly be deployed where they get the highest sort of market return in terms of ridership on large arterials, and that those will be retrofitted to make those vehicles more successful in terms of better bus stops, in terms of signal priority, in terms of bus lanes. And I think you'll see that transit agencies may find creative ways of contracting with private entities for some of the sort of subsidiary or feeder services, but that they need to be, you know, in lower density areas or at particular times of day, and that they'll need to be doing that really with their eyes open about what they're paying for and what they're getting, because ultimately it's, you know, it is tax money, and you want that to be spent in an effective way that gets a good return for the public. So, yeah, I think you'll see a lot more variety in terms of the offerings, but that variety will be sort of tailored to apply the right technology to the right types of places at the right cost, and more consciousness of who's being served and what we're actually trying to achieve with the technology.
David, thank you for being with us this morning. We appreciate having the conversation with you.
Yeah, you're very welcome. It's really exciting to see what the potential is in Chicago with this new commitment and with Active Transportation Alliance really and for other community groups really pushing for bus improvements. It's something that would be really good to do.
Well, please come back and join us.
Okay, thank you.
David Bragdon, the executive director of transitcenter.org. Transitcenter.org is the website to find out more.
WGN Radio's Daily Conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Welcome back. It's 5:38 now here on our Tuesday edition of The Opening Bell. What is the future of work and the American worker? A new book tries to tackle that question. The Once and Future Worker, A Vision for the Renewal of Work in America. The author is Orrin Kass, a senior fellow at Manhattan Institute for Policy Research, and is with us this morning on the telephone. Orrin, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I want to talk about the lots of different things from the book, but first let's do sort of an overview. The Once and Future Worker, A Vision for the Renewal of Work in America. What were you hoping to address here?
Well, I really wanted to talk about the importance of work, both to our economy, but also just to people and their families and their communities. I think we've moved as a nation to an almost exclusive focus on consumers and consumption, and the more cheap stuff we have, the happier we think we'll be. And yet that hasn't worked out so well, and I think it's because in pursuing that, we've really abandoned work and workers and stopped paying attention to what's important to people on the job.
We have been dealing with it here in Chicago in northern Illinois, a couple of different competitions for big jobs projects. One of them across the border in Wisconsin was Foxconn. We were just rejected for the Amazon headquarters. Why are we all competing for these big bids, these big projects like this? And how does this impact workers either negatively or positively in your view?
Well, I think these bids are a perfect example of how important work is, and the fact that these communities, you know, whether they win or lose, they're offering everything they can think of to get more employers to come, and it's because these jobs have so much value to the communities. And you contrast that with how, you know, you look at the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington and how they think about it. They say having these jobs come would be a cost, and that they think communities don't want it. So we've got these things backward, and yet if we want to go in and create more jobs and support work, going company by company and trying to bid for each one is a terrible idea, and it's a bad deal for taxpayers, because now you look at where, you know, Foxconn in Wisconsin or Amazon in New York and D.C., they get all these huge benefits and tax breaks, but why are they the only ones who get it? Why shouldn't any company have the same treatment? So we really have to stop doing this bidding company by company and instead say, how can we change the conditions in our economy so that any company, so that anyone who wants to go out and hire people has our support to do that?
How does that play out from a regional standpoint? Is it folks who are in regional or rural areas away from some of these city centers that aren't getting these jobs? How are they impacted by all of this?
Well, they've certainly been negatively impacted by the trajectory our economy has taken and the priority our policymakers have had, which is, you know, we've made it incredibly easy and attractive to build businesses in finance or technology, these kinds of industries that don't do anything in the physical world, that don't employ a lot of people, that certainly don't employ a lot of less skilled people. And then we've made it as hard and unprofitable as possible to go and build successful businesses of the kind that we had in the past in other parts of the country. And some people say, oh, well, you know, it's just technology. This is just an unavoidable trend. But that's not true. There's nothing about trends in our society that make it inevitable that, you know, coastal cities are going to benefit and everybody else is going to lose. If we want to have a society where places all over the country win, where you can live where you grew up and build a good life there. We can have that too. We just have to make it our priority, and right now it's not.
And that brings us to post-midterms. Now that the election is over and we have a Democratic House and Republican Senate, are these the kinds of issues that they should be dealing with? I'm sure there would be it seems to me that it's a no-brainer to think that there'd be bipartisan support to have solutions, broader solutions to some of these issues that we're talking about.
Well, it should be something that everybody wants to work on. And, you know, certainly out on the campaign trail, everyone says they care about good jobs. I think the problem is that when you actually sit down and start talking about policy, you realize that there are some real trade-offs that we have to grapple with. So, you know, I mentioned in the environmental context, you know, you might have to say having the cleanest possible air isn't always the top priority. And obviously that's going to upset some people. Another big one is in terms of education. We've built this system that focuses completely on college for all, puts all of our money into high schools that prepare people for college, and then puts a lot of the money into college. And yet most Americans aren't even earning a community college degree. So I think it's just common sense to say, wait a minute, we have this backward. The people who need our help, the people we should be focusing on, are the people who aren't headed for college. But if you do that, you know, you're gonna anger an awful lot of the sort of upper middle class folks who really like the idea that someone else is going to pay for college for their kids, and so I think these are exactly the trade-offs that we have to grapple with, and we have to be willing to say, if we care about everybody's success in society, having a labor market where everybody can succeed, then it can't just be about raising taxes and mailing checks to people who got left behind. We have to actually be prepared to reorient some things in our economy to make it one that's going to work for everybody.
Yeah, and part of that reorienting might include directing safety net spending toward wage subsidies. I know people have been talking about a universal income as perhaps a solution moving forward, but this notion of making it a safety net project is one that seems appealing.
Yeah, I mean, that's a perfect example. This idea of universal basic income is kind of the logical endpoint for the people who are doing really well and don't want to think about everybody else. The idea is basically, let's just create a policy where we send checks to everybody every month. That's enough to live on. And so sure, you know, rich people have to pay higher taxes, but they're happy to pay higher taxes if they don't have to change anything else in their lives. And I think we actually have to go the other direction and say, no, we can't move toward a society where some people are the economic winners and kind of pay everybody else to go away and leave them alone. We actually have to go the other direction and say, this society is only going to work. We are only going to have a successful nation if it's one that's inclusive and where everybody can work and everyone can be a productive contributor. And that's not the direction we're headed right now, and it requires really this focus on the renewal of work and saying the most important thing isn't, you know, economic growth is important, but it's not the only thing. And if we're doing growth in a way that leaves people behind, that's not acceptable. We actually have to put a much bigger priority on choosing the kinds of policies and having the kind of culture that that creates opportunities for everyone to be a worker.
Orrin, I haven't had a conversation yet about the future of work that doesn't include robots and automation and what impact that would have on all of us. What are your thoughts on that? And is the future... are you optimistic about the future in this regard, or pessimistic?
I'm optimistic in this regard. I think, obviously, as you said, every conversation ends up with this question, well, what about the robots? And the reality is that robots can be workers' best friends. Robots, or any sort of technology that makes it possible to make more stuff with less hours of work or with fewer workers, that's the exact formula for rising prosperity, whether you're talking about the assembly line in factories or mechanization in agriculture or now computers and robots, allowing workers to produce more with less time, that's how you get their wages to go up. That's exactly what we should want. The question is, as that's happening, what's happening in the broader economy? As that's happening, are we seeing more additional opportunities for workers? Are we seeing demand to make more stuff? Or do you get into a situation where the robots start to make more stuff and we say, well, then we just don't need these other workers? And that's where it can go wrong. So there's nothing from history that says robots need to be a problem. Historically, all of this technology has been great. The problem comes if you don't use it in the context of an economy that is really valuing roles for workers, too.
It is interesting that in this time of low unemployment, where we have all these jobs being created and everybody saying how happy they are about that, that there is still a thought that workers are still in a state of crisis. How do we put these two things together and sort of understand both items?
Well, I think you have to distinguish the business cycle, meaning are you in a boom or are you in a recession, from the longer-term trend. And it's certainly true that right now things look much better than they did in the depth of the recession, you know, 5-10 years ago. But that's not the right comparison. The right comparison is how does it look compared to past booms. And so if you compare today to, you know, before the financial crisis or during the dot-com boom or even back in the late 80s, what you see is that there are many, many, many more prime-age workers, meaning people between 25 and 54, so the years when they're supposed to be working, men in particular, see a much higher share of them just not working, not even looking for work. And that's a share that keeps going up. It's worse this boom than it was during the last boom, worse during the last boom than the boom before that. So absolutely, we should celebrate that we're having a boom. That's sure as heck better than having a recession. But it doesn't change the long-run picture, which is that our economy continues to drift away from the interests of the typical worker. And if the next recession comes, and it will come, and the boom that comes after that is even worse than this one, we're still on that downhill slope. And we have to turn that around so that the actual picture, not just this year, but over the next 20 or 40 years, starts to look a lot better than what we've had over the last few decades.
How does all of this work into the 2020 presidential election? Will this be front and center in that campaign?
I think it will be. I mean, I think whatever you think of Donald Trump, one reason he had a lot of success and one thing he really brought in 2016 was a different way of talking about some of these problems. I mean, both parties, Republicans and Democrats, had always just talked about consumption. You may have heard the term the economic pie. Right, as long as we grow the economic pie, everybody can have a bigger slice. And what that meant was, as long as the economy keeps getting bigger, we can always give everybody enough stuff. Republicans said, well, as long as we keep cutting taxes, the economy will grow and everybody will win. And Democrats said, well, that's not quite true. We're also going to have to redistribute. We're going to have bigger safety net programs. And Donald Trump came along and said, that's not what people care about. That's not what's going wrong here. The problem is that for a huge chunk of workers and communities, they're just being left behind. They're not having a chance to build their own productive lives. And so I think we've seen that shift in our national discussion, and that will continue in 2020. The question is whether it will see the follow-through with actual policies. You know, it's easy to say you care about work and then go back to talking about the exact same set of policies you were talking about before. And so far, that's especially what we've seen from Democrats and from the folks who are kind of getting ready to run for president. All of their ideas are just new ideas to mail bigger checks to people. And they all have their own one, and they'll all compete over who has the biggest check. But I don't think that's the right way of thinking about it. I don't think it's going to be a very effective message. I think we actually have to get back to talking about how are we going to really make some trade-offs in our society so that the folks who are being left behind actually have a chance to catch up and have a chance to participate.
Orrin, thank you for giving us plenty to think about here. We appreciate your time, and congratulations on your book.
Thank you. Really appreciate the chance to talk with you.
Orrin Cass is the author of The Once and Future Worker, A Vision for the Renewal of Work in America, also a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research. And again, the book is called The Once and Future Worker, A Vision for the Renewal of Work in America.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward opening losses later on Wall Street, with Dow futures off more than 0.5%, now down 134 points. NASDAQ futures off more than 1%. S&P futures off more than 0.5%. It's been a rough morning all around the globe, in Asia and in Europe as well. Let's get the latest on agriculture and commodities now. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. At the Chicago Mercantile Exchange yesterday, lean hog futures rose to life of contract highs, extending the limit up move we saw on Friday. Optimism for strong exports of American pork due to the worsening African swine fever outbreak in China. So February hog futures were up $2.27 at $69.02 a hundredweight. Live cattle futures higher for the third straight session. December cattle ending up 80 cents at $116.15 a hundredweight. Meanwhile, at the Chicago Board of Trade grain market today, soybeans dropped because of concerns over the U.S.-China trade situation. That's been going on now for a year, it seems. Soybean futures for January at the end of the day down 18.5 cents. December soft red winter wheat down 8.25 cents. And December corn down 2.5 cents. The weekly crop progress reports issued yesterday showed 90% of the nation's corn crop harvested as of Sunday night, little less than traders were expecting. But in Illinois, combines are probably parked 100% of the corn crop harvested, Iowa 91%, Wisconsin 80%. Soybeans harvested 91%, that's about 2 percentage points below expectations. Illinois, 96%, Iowa, 97%, Indiana, 93%, and Wisconsin, 91% of the soybean crop harvested. And that's your money on 720 WGN.
Thanks, Orion. Before we leave you, a couple of stories happening this morning. Target, among big companies reporting earnings today, reported a mixed quarter with revenue slightly topping analyst expectations, but earnings fall short. Investments in its supply chain apparently weighing heavy on Target profit margins. Despite the miss, Target maintained its forecast for the full year, but its shares are down as much as 10% in pre-market trading. Target, again, reporting earnings this morning. Also, Lowe's has an earnings beat, but the retailer has cut its forecast as it moves to exit some of its business. Lowe's this morning reporting quarterly earnings and revenue that beat analyst expectations, though some same-store sales were softer than Wall Street had hoped. The company lowering full-year estimates. Earnings per share of $1.04 adjusted at 90, that's adjusted versus the 98 cents that was expected. The revenue $17.42 billion versus $17.36 billion. Lowe's reported a net income of $629 million in the third quarter. Another story that we're watching for you this morning involves American Airlines. Union leaders say pilots will push American Airlines for more pay and schedule changes that they say will reduce flight delays. The president of the Allied Pilots Association says pilots will seek industry-leading wages when their current contract is due for renewal in January of 2020. They're working under a 2015 contract that granted immediate 23% raises plus 3% each year. In 2017, American gave its pilots and flight attendants additional pay raises that totaled close to $1 billion and angered some investors. The association wants American to reduce its practice of shifting on-duty pilots to fill in for others who call in sick, can't legally handle a flight because of crew test requirements or other reasons. American has the worst on-time record this year of the four largest U.S. airlines. And now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for this Tuesday, November 20th. A couple of big news items today on the schedule of economic reports. Housing starts are due out along with the building permits coming. We'll see the Red Book kind of get a snapshot for how retailers are doing. On the earnings calendar, we mentioned Target, but BJ's Wholesale Club reporting today. In addition to Lowe's, it's Best Buy, Barnes & Noble, Campbell Soup, and Gap. Just some of the things that could move the markets on this Tuesday, November the 20th.